Good morning. First case this morning is the reappearance of United States v. Catso. Is the appellant prepared to argue? Is the government prepared?
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant may argue.
Your Honor, I think it's a TJ certified case.
Oh, this is a certified case. You are right. The United States goes first. I am sorry. I apologize.
We reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Chief Judge Suki, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Tyler Musselman, and with me is Ms. Mary Ellen Payne, and together we represent the United States in this proceeding. The Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals erroneously relied on its previously overturned decision to grant relief. In doing so, the court misapplied Miller in RCM 305 to hold that appellee was entitled to continued confinement hearing and to erroneously grant automatic day-for-day administrative confinement credit. The United States requests this court rectify these errors and reverse AFCA's decision in this case. Before this court, I would like to focus on four errors by AFCA. First, address how issues relating to continued confinement were mooted by this court's decision. Second, discuss how Miller does not require a continued confinement hearing unless an appellee requests it. Third, explain how AFCA erred in granting automatic credit. And fourth, briefly demonstrate the lack of any prejudice in this case. Regarding mootness, first, when this court overturned AFCA's erroneous initial decision, any issue relating to the propriety of appellee's continued confinement was mooted. In Miller, this court held that a continued confinement review process is tied to an appellee's interest in a favorable decision of the lower court. When this court overturned AFCA's initial decision, there was no favorable decision of the lower court at that point. When AFCA considered appellee's request for relief, that previous favorable decision no longer existed. It evaporated when this court reversed it. AFCA was bound to apply the law at the time of the consideration of appellee's claim for relief for continued confinement credit. This court's reversal of AFCA established that first, that continued confinement was warranted, but it also meant that any error merely resulted in appellee serving his lawfully adjudged sentence. Now, mootness when it comes to errors in confinement or deferral of confinement, this court has addressed it in previous precedent. In Brown and Sitton, this court held that any error or abuse of discretion in denying deferral of confinement was mooted because the appellant in that case had previously served his entire confinement sentence. The Supreme Court has also held that in situations regarding pretrial bail, an ultimate conviction moots any issues relating to erroneous denial of pretrial bail in Murphy v. Hunt. And the federal circuits continue to apply that today. These cases are applicable because they demonstrate that later circumstances can moot a claim for relief for, relating to deferral of confinement. Therefore, AFCA erred when it relied on its previously overturned decision. The United States requests this court hold that the issue was mooted and reverse AFCA's decision on that ground. Now, alternatively, even if this court finds that the issue is ripe for review, that it was ripe for review when AFCA heard it, a confinement hearing...
Has the sentence been served? Sentence has not been served, has it?
No, Judge Suki, and I would say that's one thing that distinguishes this case from...
It's still hanging out. The confinement and presumably the discharge are still hanging out there.
Yes, Your Honor. My understanding, this isn't before the court, but...
So what is mooted exactly? I can see that Catso would, in a sense, has gone away. But now we're in Catso 2 or 3. I've lost count. So what's mooted, or what can we do here? Well, leaving aside what the government wants us to do here, what can we do here?
Well, Your Honor, I think it was legal error for AFCA not to rely on its previous decision, which had been erased. As I stated in Miller, this court held that the continued confinement review process is tied to a favorable decision of the lower court. There was no favorable decision of the lower court in existence when AFCA heard this case the second time around.
Well, we wouldn't be here, based on decisions of the lower court unless TJAG had certified it.
Well, Your Honor, what I'm addressing is the Catso 1 in which AFCA threw out the findings and sentence.
So is your point that the confinement credit that they gave should be ungiven? We should say that they're wrong and that they couldn't give the confinement credit.
And there's multiple reasons for that, yes. One,
that ultimately is why you're here.
That's correct, yes. And so AFCA, by relying on a previously overturned case, that was legal error on their part. And that was their first step, and that was a legal error that ultimately resulted in them granting confinement credit. They should have never got to the issue in the first instance. And so the mootness argument, I think, pertains to issue two, which is whether AFCA should have granted automatic credit. It stands to reason that if they never should have reached the issue in the first place, they never should have granted credit.
So it's your position that when they actually did have a continued confinement hearing, that was mistaken. They should not have conducted that at the request of CATSO.
No, Your Honor, what I'm saying is...
Well, why, when you're saying it's moot, why would they, to have CATSO request a hearing and then have one, why would the government go forward with
it? It was moot at the time of AFCA's second consideration of Appellee's case. In other words, it was a subsequent circumstance. It was this court's overturning of AFCA's initial decision that subsequently mooted any impropriety, alleged impropriety, and continued confinement. And you can see that in Murphy v. Hunt. In that case, the appellant, the Supreme Court case, the appellant challenged the pretrial bail ruling, and the Supreme Court said there's no legal issue here. And in doing so, it overturned, I think, the lower court, which held that the pretrial bail statute was unconstitutional. It said it should have never reached the issue. So that's our first argument. Our second
Counsel,
one is that...
Before we leave that, then, are you contending that we are bound by the Supreme Court's decision with respect to bail, or is that an analogy that you're asking us to consider?
An analogy, Your Honor, because I believe what they're reviewing in that case is specifically the federal Bail Reform Act.
There's no bail in the armed forces, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And same thing for Brown and Sitton. They're both, I think, extremely analogous because you're talking about deferral of confinement, but this is initial deferral of confinement. But I think they are analogous and part of this court's precedent. Moving on to the second argument is, Appellee had to request the continued confinement hearing. And our basis for that is Moore and Miller and the fact that they relied on Article 57 at the time, which requested an appellee, which required that an appellee request deferral of confinement. Moore, which is the precursor to Miller, relied on Article 57 as it existed, which required someone to request deferral of their confinement.
In the federal system, which was cited in those cases, is the appellant required to request a hearing, or is a hearing required under Title 18?
Your Honor, I don't practice the federal civilian circuit, so I'm going to do my best.
It's cited in the CCA opinions in this case.
Yes, Your Honor, and so what I'm going to give you is my read of the statute, which is 18 U.S.C. 3142 and 18 U.S.C. 3143. 3142 is bail before trial, 3143 is bail before appeal, and my understanding is 3143, to receive bail on appeal, the defendant has to, or the appellant has to, supply a motion to the court. That's based on my read of the statute as well as, and I haven't cited these cases, district court opinions where they're hearing bail motions. Now, I will say and caveat that with, when the government takes what would be our equivalent of an Article 62 appeal, I think the statutes kick it to the trial level's discretion, in other words. And when it's on appeal, the federal system, as my understanding, requires the appellant to make the showing that he's not going to be a dangerous society or flee, whereas as if it's before trial, the burden is on the government to show that they would be a risk or he would flee. So that's my understanding. And long story short, if it's on appeal, they have to request for release, is my understanding. But prior to trial, I think it's the government that has to put in and move to have them detained. So when you look at Moore and Miller and what they're based on and stand for, in those cases, those cases are based on legal precedent that required an appellee to request release, and the appellees in those cases actually did request release. I think in both Moore and Miller, the appellee filed writs of extraordinary relief to be released. In Kreutzer, this court pointed out, now this, it wasn't an issue before the court, honestly, but it pointed out that appellant was a prisoner convicted of very serious offenses, which that's distinguishable here, but the court pointed out he had not requested and did not request release from confinement. I think that was an important fact in Kreutzer. When you go through the facts of that case, you actually see that continued confinement hearing was held months down the road, but this court made it a point to point out that he had not requested release. And in other situations, this court holds an appellant or a confinee's feet to the fire to actually request relief or to raise the issue. And I point to United States v. Wise. In Eighth Amendment, Article 55, Article 12, this court expects an appellant to exhaust administrative remedies, Article 138, that sort of thing, and file grievances. So as far as confinement issues or issues with confinement, there is precedent for this court to state that an appellant has to raise the issue, an appellee. So our alternative argument, if this case isn't moot, is that appellee had to ask for this relief, that the government wasn't obligated to provide a continued confinement hearing until he did so. And in this case, appellee requested a continued confinement hearing, which was held 9 days after the order of the continued confinement hearing and 12 days after his request. He was represented by counsel, offered evidence, and presented an argument, and the continued confinement officer came down with appellee should remain confined. These efforts, taken within a reasonable time of appellee's request for relief, constituted compliance with the procedures in Miller. Therefore, it was error for AFCA to say that the government was obligated to hold the hearing within 7 days, even though he had never requested it.
Counsel, in this situation, you've noted that the rules for courts martial do not address this issue of hearings at the appellate process. Is the president prohibited from addressing that issue?
No, Your Honor.
Is the president authorized? Does the president have sufficient discretion in terms of the rules that the president could establish to establish the rule that the lower court articulated in this case? I'm not asking you to say whether you would agree with it or not, but is it within the president's authority?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd say because of Article 57A.
So if the president hasn't exercised that authority, why is the lower court prohibited from adopting a rule that is a rule that the president could adopt in this case where the president has not yet occupied the field?
Well, Your Honor, I think that they are effectively the CCA did engage in rulemaking in this case, and I don't think that that was appropriate. I also think that it contravenes precedent from this court, and I base that argument off of what I see as my interpretation of Moore and Miller. I think the president could hold the government to a stricter burden, but I don't think the lower court here was in a position to engage in such rulemaking.
Point that the statute expressly authorized the president to create rules, and it doesn't say anything about the CCA making up new rules.
That's correct. Yes, Your Honor.
Is the court below prohibited from interpreting cases which have come from this court that use Rule 305 by analogy to more closely approximate the federal civilian practice as suggested in the separate opinion by the court below, the separate opinion that disagreed with the majority view, but specifically said on page 12 that there's a requirement to conduct a review under federal law?
I think, Your Honor, what we have here is it either beyond the stuff of interpretation in that it is rulemaking, which has not been given to the CCA, or alternatively, they whatever their analysis, their interpretation was wrong. I think that's the majority of our brief, is that they erroneously...
Right. But if the court below, and this court may conclude that they did engage in rulemaking, but are they prohibited from occupying a space that is left vacant by the president, not in terms of rulemaking, but interpreting the scope of their authority under the statute and under the RCMs?
I think they went beyond what was allowed here, and I think ultimately their conclusion likely contradicts with Article 57A itself when it states that the secretary may defer, which is a discretionary, the may in there, and here you have the court saying the government will do it on this date and in this fashion. I think you can see the problem with the policy and the rulemaking in this when you look at how their opinion is framed. They struggle with RCM 305 doesn't apply, but we're going to apply it. RCM 305K doesn't apply, but we're going to apply it. I think that...
Cases don't say to look at RCM 305 by analogy?
I think they say look at RCM 305 as to sort of how a continued confinement hearing would be structured, but that is it itself in and of it. I think they don't say anything about 305K. That was never addressed in Moore, Miller, or Kreutzer.
Right, so why are they prohibited from looking at that by analogy?
I think because of the plain language of 305 itself when you're talking about pretrial confinement.
But if 305 doesn't govern this area and it's used by analogy, why are they prohibited from also engaging in an analogy for ascertaining whether there's a requirement or whether it's discretionary?
Chief Judge Suki, I see I'm out of time.
You can answer the question.
I think that what you have here is when the discretion's been left to the president and you have a lower court that came up with these finite rules, they've basically taken one structure or one rule that in and of itself is explicitly tied to pretrial confinement. And when they take the details and specific rules from that and then put it into an area that was never intended to be, that's where they stepped outside their bounds. And I think you can see it with how the rationale struggles within the majority opinion, and that's pointed out by the chief judge in his dubitante opinion. And if there's no further questions, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Yes, I do. Major Musselman, I have one question. What do you make of the fact that 57A was decided in 1996, and Miller comes along in 1997? And Miller makes no reference to the deferment statute. All of its reference appears to be to RCM 305. What do you make of that? I mean, does it mean that the court looked at RCM? I mean, the court looked at Article 57A and said, no, that's not what should apply here? Because they continue to look to RCM 305 as the source for resolving this issue.
You know, I think your answer is when you look at Miller, they cite specifically to Moore. And you see it more, that's where the court sort of develops this continued confinement hearing. By stating,
no, I understand that, but I mean, if all that is the case, why didn't the court just look to in Miller, just look to Article 57A and say, hey, look, we have here the answer to the question here, the answer to the question on appeal for an accused who seeks to be released is Article 57A. Why didn't they just say that?
Well, I think ultimately they didn't point to it, but really the reference to RCM 305 is just was just a practical.
Well, my point is they didn't have to refer to RCM 305. I mean, if I followed some of your reasoning, which is Article 57A, is really the answer to the question here. I'm not asking you to either concede or make that point necessarily, but it could be. And if it is, why didn't the court just say that instead of continuing to refer to RCM 305?
Yes, Your Honor, I think the answer to that is the RCM 305-like hearing is the mechanism at which we get to the answer of whether or not deferral.
So you would play them together. In your view, they play together?
I think so.
I got you. Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor, that's the answer to that. Okay. I think you look at them together. The RCM 305 hearing is the mechanism where the authority is 57A, if that makes sense.
Okay.
If there are no further questions.
Thank you. Appellee may argue.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey and members of the court. May it please the court. I am Captain Patrick Clary, and along with Colonel Jane Boomer, we represent the appellee, Airman Basic Joshua Katso. In its first opinion in this case, the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals completely set aside Airman Katso's findings of guilty and his sentence. In the court's own words, it had nullified his criminal liability. After the Judge Advocate General certified this case for the first time to this court, the government had two options: release Airman Katso or hold a hearing to justify why he should remain in confinement. The government kept Airman Katso in confinement, but did not hold a hearing, and continued to do so for 372 days. This was a violation of Airman Katso's procedural rights under United States v. Miller and RCM 305, and the CCA did not err by granting him day-for-day credit for each day he spent in confinement without a hearing to which he was entitled.
Well, I'm going to ask the same question that Judge Sparks asked. You got Miller, the statute changes. It's Hornbook law that what the president does can't contravene the statute. So no matter what 305 says, no matter what Miller says, he didn't ask for it. Therefore, what's the problem? I know Miller post-amending the statute says that. Is Miller wrong? If it's not wrong, on what grounds is it right?
Your Honor, the government has not asked this court to overrule Miller. And as Judge Sparks acknowledged that 57 Alpha was passed in 1996, this court decided Miller in 1996.
Right. So, and I'm asking you, is Miller wrong in that respect? And if not, why not?
No, Your Honor, Miller's not wrong. Miller extended RCM 305 to this unique procedural context. And it's an independent...
But you got a statute out here that says he's got to ask for it.
Your Honor, this court's free to overrule its own precedent.
It's free to overrule its own precedent, but it's not free to ignore a statute.
Correct, Your Honor. The Miller requirement to hold a continued confinement hearing runs independently of the option that an appellant has to seek a deferment of confinement pursuant to Article 57 Alpha.
My understanding of the government's argument, and they'll be free, of course, to amplify it, was that the government took the position that the president had the authority to impose what the Court of Criminal Appeals did in this case. But in the absence of the president doing that, there was that the lower court erred by saying that it was required.
Lower court, Your Honor, was following this court's precedent in Miller. And this court has had an opportunity to reconsider Miller on a couple occasions, most recently in Kreutzer in 2012, but has not overruled Miller. So Miller was good law at the time the CCA was presented with this question, and it would have been error for the CCA to ignore this court's precedent. That seemed to be the disagreement among the majority in the dubitante opinion in the lower court. So Miller, at the time that the CCA considered this issue, was binding precedent. And they had to apply Miller. Now, if Miller changes, and that certainly changes the calculus for Herman Katso.
So I understand the disagreement between the parties here. It's not that Article 57 precludes a requirement for confinement hearing to be held, but rather that in the absence of presidential action, it's the court below erred by imposing that requirement.
The lower court did not impose any requirement that wasn't required by United States versus Miller. Miller says that in this circumstance, after certification, a continued confinement hearing has to be held if the government wants to keep Herman Katso in confinement. And Miller refers specifically to RCM 305.
But Miller filed a writ of habeas corpus, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So, I mean, he took some action saying, I should be let out.
Right? That's correct.
And isn't that the same thing that happened in Moore?
In Moore, Your Honor, I believe it was a writ as well.
Okay, and so in this case, your client does nothing for a year, and then he finally does say something, I should be let out, something should happen, and they give him a hearing, and they say, no, you should stay in. So what's the problem?
There's nothing in United States v. Miller, Your Honor, or the couple of cases that analyze Miller that imposes any requirement on Herman Katso to remind the government that they have an obligation under that case to hold a continued confinement hearing. And Herman Katso did.
You're assuming that they have the obligation. What I'm saying is in the two cases that you're relying on, the obligation was switched on, so to speak, by request by the incarcerated accused.
Well, in Miller, Your Honor, for example, the accused in that case attempted to get credit for a period of confinement that occurred prior to TJAG certification. And what Miller said and what was affirmed later in Kreutzer was that the predicate for a Miller hearing is not anything that Airman Katso or someone like in his position has, but it's the predicate is TJAG's certification decision.
That's not what the statute says, right?
That's not what Article 57 Alpha says, Your Honor. It's our position that Article 57 Alpha is a different avenue for relief than what's required under Miller.
So, Counsel, you seem to be predicating your whole argument this morning on what was decided in Miller. Let's engage in a little thought experiment. Let's pretend there was no Miller. How would you end up with the same result that would benefit your client?
Your Honor, if this court overturns Miller, then we have to concede that Airman Katso loses his appeal. But if the court goes in that direction, what we request is that this court remand the case back to the CCA so that it can consider its authority under Article 66C and sentence appropriateness to potentially address the issue in this case.
Should it concern this court that you would ask that Miller be construed in such a manner that what could be described as a process foul could result in what also could be described as an unfair windfall?
Your Honor, I disagree that the relief in this case is an unfair windfall for the simple fact that the government made a litigation decision in this case to read in a requirement into Miller that doesn't exist in that case, is that the continued confinement hearing is somehow predicated on something that Airman Katso does.
But Miller doesn't address that point, does it?
It says that a continued confinement hearing is required after the Judge Advocate General certifies the case. And so, and the CCA followed this court's precedent in saying that it had to occur after certification. It looked to RCM 305 and applied the outer limits of temporally of when a hearing has to happen, which is 7 days. So the CCA in this case merely followed this court's precedent in Miller, applied the plain language of that ruling, and adopted RCM 305, which was extended to this situation by this court.
Is it inconsistent with Miller? Why is it inconsistent with Miller to say, yes, the hearing's required, but there will be no error or alternatively no prejudicial error in the absence of a request?
Because as in this case, Your Honor, the purpose of a continued confinement hearing is to impose upon the government a responsibility to justify why someone who wins at the CCA should remain in confinement indefinitely after certification. It's the government who is attempting to confine Airman Katso in this situation. It's their responsibility to justify it. And furthermore, in a case like this,
the person is confined at that time. Is that?
He was confined at that time, correct, Your Honor.
And so why is it inconsistent with Miller to say, yes, there's a requirement, but the requirement itself is not triggered unless there's a request? The obligation to meet that requirement isn't triggered unless there's a request.
Rather, because Miller doesn't say that.
But it arose in the context of a request.
It did, Your Honor.
I mean, that's the factual background against or backdrop against which Miller was decided.
Correct, Your Honor.
Miller is not a, excuse me.
So, I mean, I completely understand why it would make sense that if the government loses at the CCA and decides not to certify the case, I understand then how a confined person is now a pretrial detainee, if anything, and why automatically the government has to do something if they want to keep them in confinement, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
But when the government is certifying a case, meaning that they don't agree, right, and when it may turn out, as it did in this case, that the government ends up prevailing on appeal, why wouldn't the person need to do something?
Airman Katso did do something, Your Honor. He did file a motion with this court asking for a remand so that this violation could be litigated at the CCA.
Right, but I mean, it was long past the time, right, when the government had certified the case.
Miller points to RCM 305, and nothing in RCM 305 imposes any burden on the confinee to remind the government that they have procedural rights.
That's because they're in pretrial confinement. They don't have a sentence that's been adjudged against them.
In this case, Your Honor, the CCA, although it was an inchoate decision, had set aside all of his findings of guilty and his sentence. So although that decision could not be executed on its own, he did have a strong interest in the outcome of that decision, and the government was required to justify why he remained in confinement. And there's no evidence in the record that after certification, the government notified Airman Katso that, hey, you have this right under United States versus Miller and RCM 305 to demand a continued confinement hearing.
Does Miller require that?
No, Your Honor. Miller does not require. Miller is silent on the
issue. Oh, well, I mean, you're saying the government should have notified him. Where's that come from?
No, Your Honor. My position is that if there is somehow a burden on Airman Katso to demand a continued confinement hearing pursuant to Miller, then there should be some mechanism to notify someone who is being confined at the government's request that they have this right.
It seems to me that the way that I understand it, at least, is that there's a statute that says, you know, that he can ask the relevant secretary to be released pending the decision, right? That's one thing he could do.
Correct, Your Honor.
The second thing he could do is file writ of habeas corpus saying, I'm in confinement and I shouldn't be in confinement, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And then there's this third thing, which you're saying, a continued confinement hearing, which I don't see that in the rules, but that's fine. He asked for it. They gave it to him. I'm not sure where the government gets the duty to inform him of any of those things.
Your Honor, after certification, according to Miller, it has to either release him or justify his continued confinement. It doesn't impose any requirement. The language in that opinion doesn't impose any requirement on Airman Katso.
I understand that you don't concede that we can look at that case in the context, the factual context in which it arose, which is after a request for a writ of habeas corpus. Saying, let me out.
Correct, Your Honor.
To follow up on that, is there any language in Miller in which the issue of an absence of request is discussed?
No, Your Honor.
Is there any other case in which you would cite to in which an absence of a request is discussed?
No, Your Honor. I'm not aware of any case.
And what about in federal civilian practice, which was discussed by the court below?
No, Your Honor, my understanding.
What happens if there's no request?
There's no request, Your Honor. My understanding is the government's obligation to hold a hearing.
What happens if the government doesn't hold a hearing? What remedy is provided under those circumstances? If the government doesn't hold a hearing, what remedy is provided in federal civilian practice?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of the remedy in that particular statute. It's something I could look into and provide a supplemental filing from the court.
That'll be up to the court. So we don't know whether the issues that the government has raised with respect to mootness or no prejudice would or would not apply in the absence of a request in the civilian model that is referenced.
Correct, Your Honor.
And is referenced in our prior cases.
Yes, Your Honor. Regarding the remedy, CCA did not err by granting Airman Katso a single day of confinement credit for each day he spent in confinement without a required hearing. The prejudice and mootness arguments shift the focus away from the error that the CCA actually found in this case. The Air Force Court did not say that Airman Katso served confinement that he should not have, or that the review officer applied the wrong standard or considered the wrong evidence. What they found was a procedural violation of Airman Katso's procedural rights under RCM 305 in United States versus Miller, and they fashioned a remedy to address that procedural violation. U.S. v. Miller references RCM 305, and the court did not err by looking to that rule to find the remedy under RCM 305K. That rule does not attempt to make Airman Katso whole for the confinement that he served, but it's a reminder to the government that it has requirements under the law to hold hearings when it's required to. And it's an incentive to the government to follow the procedures under RCM 305 and, by extension, United States versus Miller.
Well, and where does the requirement for the hearing come from again?
The requirement for a hearing, Your Honor, comes from this court's case in United States versus
Miller. It comes from Miller.
Correct, Your Honor.
Right. Does not come from statute.
No, Your Honor.
Okay. It does not come from the reg, the MRE. The RCM.
Well, Miller extends RCM 305 to this situation.
But it fundamentally, it says it's there because we say so.
That was in 1997, Your Honor. And
right.
The President and Congress,
I'm aware of that.
Right. The President and the Congress have had 20 years, if they disagree with the rule in Miller, to either promulgate a rule or pass a statute to correct that, and they haven't. So Miller remains good law. And the CCA was forced to.
Well, what do you make of Article 57A? And is it just out there and it applies to a different situation? It's not clear to me what your argument with respect to the statute is.
Yes, Your Honor. It's our position that Article 57A is a separate avenue for relief that an appellant in this kind of circumstance can pursue.
He could pursue.
Correct, Your Honor.
You don't see that as placing an obligation on the.
There, Your Honor. It's not stated in Miller. Miller doesn't specifically reference Article 57 Alpha. And there's a case called Clark versus United States. It's a Navy Marine Corps case that's cited by the government in their brief, which references Article 57 Alpha as evidence that Congress intended for there to be some mechanism for an appellant in this kind of circumstance to seek relief, and then approvingly cites to Miller and the procedures outlined in Miller. So I don't think that Article 57 Alpha and Miller are inconsistent. They're just separate avenues for relief.
Which part of Article 57A are you focusing on?
Your Honor, it's Article 57A, paragraph C, which after provides for post-certification requests to the Secretary for deferment of confinement.
And does C require a request on the part of the individual?
Your Honor, it appears to require a request. Otherwise, it's not clear how that would be effectuated upon request from the accused. Correct, Your Honor.
Why? What language in C requires?
Right, I don't have that statute in front of me, but it appears that, just practically speaking, that could only be effectuated after someone asked for it. But unlike that statute in Miller, the predicate for a hearing is not anything that Airman Katso or someone situated like him has
so
to do.
You're saying that the President and the Secretary of the Service are precluded from issuing regulations requiring that a deferment be considered?
No, Your Honor. So after Miller, for 20 years, there's been inaction by the President and the Congress on this particular issue, and so Miller remains good law, and the CCA was required to apply it. It certainly was an error for a lower court to apply this court's precedent. Pending any other questions from the court, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, counsel. Does the government have rebuttal?
Your Honor, first I'd like to touch on appellee's request at this court. If it determines that AFCA erred, remand for a 66C sentence appropriateness review. The court's already conducted one. When you review the opinion of AFCA, it reviewed the case for sentence appropriate and determined that the adjudged sentence was appropriate. It then granted administrative day-for-day credit, which, of course, the United States suggests is error. Therefore, no additional Article 66 review is needed. Next, I'd like to touch on Miller. This court need not overturn Miller. As Judge Ryan has pointed out, in Miller, the appellee in that case had requested release through an extraordinary writ. It can bring together Miller and Article 57A without overturning previous precedent.
Counsel, focusing on 57A, do you agree with the defense that the aspect of 57A is at issue is subsection C?
Yes, Your Honor.
Addresses whether a request is or is not required.
Your Honor, my position is that 57C is an extension of A, which mandates a request, and when you look at C, there is no requirement in there that the Secretary conduct or have a sua sponte review done.
And I understand there may not be a requirement, but is there a prohibition? In other words, is there a requirement for a request? You're taking the position that there's no requirement to sua sponte hold a hearing. My question is there a requirement at sea for a request? The language says, in any case. It doesn't just say those cases in which there's an application.
I think that practically speaking, that's the only way to effectuate it.
Saying the president couldn't issue a rule that says, in any case, you will conduct a hearing? I'm not asking you to agree that that would be good policy or not, but are you saying the president would be precluded from interpreting Article 57A, subsection C, as precluding the president from requiring a hearing?
I think that given, when read in concert with A, and then given the history and where it comes from, especially the deferral of confinement has always required a request, that a request is required.
That's the position of the government, including the Department of Defense and the Department of Justice, that the president would have his hands tied in requiring a hearing under subsection C?
I think our better position is that it's not required, that he sua sponte do it in every case. And that's a position that is in our brief, Your Honor. I think that when you look at the history, frankly, of Moore, Miller, 57, they all come in the context of a request for deferment. And when you're talking about a discretionary, the big may that's in the middle of 57AC, really the only way that that's going to be effectuated is if somebody makes a request. In other words, if the secretary is required to do it in every case that's certified, it wouldn't contain the word may.
Not a question of whether the statute is interpreted to require it, but whether the statute is interpreted to preclude the president from requiring it.
I think our strongest position is that there's no requirement that it be done sua sponte. I think that, and finally, I'd like to touch on briefly on my last point, if this court has no further questions on Miller and 57, which is AFCA's erroneous grant of administrative day-for-day credit in lieu of prejudice.
I actually would like to ask a question before you get there. What do you make of Captain Clary's point that 57A is just another option for the accused? In other words, he can go... The government should go with RCM 305, but as it regards Article 57A, that's just another option or avenue for the accused. And he can, I hope I'm articulating his point correctly, but that's what I thought I heard him say.
Well, I think that as it's in the statute, that is the statutory authority for deferral pending appeal after TJAG certification. In other words, it's the statute itself. Otherwise, I don't know that any other authority exists. I will tell you that the Miller developed from an interpretation of 57, I think, little d, as it had developed. And that's where the court got its statutory authority, sort of maybe not necessarily in line with the plain language of it at the time. But I would say that the statutory authority for there is no bail pending appeal in the armed forces. There's no constitutional right for it. So the statutory authority has to come from 57. But as I said before, even if Miller is its own animal, our position is that Miller, you have to request relief, and that's the context of that case. Your Honor, I see I'm out of time before I got to the prejudice argument. If there's no further questions, may I briefly conclude?
Yes.
The Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals erroneously relied on its previously overturned decision to grant relief. In doing so, the court misapplied Miller and RCM 305 to hold that appellee was entitled to a continued confinement hearing without asking for one, and to erroneously grant day-for-day credit in contradiction of Article 59A. Thank you.
Thank you. The court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court is in recess until 10:25.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:25.